All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Wisconsin State Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kinzel is reviewing the title.
Hey, please be seated. Good morning. We are here on Josh Call versus the Wisconsin State Legislature, case number 22AP 790. Let's start with your appearances, please.
Morning, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of Attorney General Josh Call, Wisconsin Department of Justice, Governor Department of Administration, Pat Colton Blumenfeld. I'm joined by my co-counsel, Assistant Attorney General Charlie Casey.
Hey, good morning. All right, good. Good morning. All right, the lineup is 25 minutes followed by 30 minutes, 5 minutes in rebuttal. That's everyone's understanding. All right, with that, please proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In every civil enforcement action, an executive agency program action prosecuted by the Department of Justice, every entity involved in authorizing and prosecuting the civil action rests within the executive branch. And every decision made as to how to resolve these categories of plaintiff side civil actions constitutes quintessential core executive power. Though the legislature neither has nor could play any role in resolving these categories of actions, the legislature has taken for itself through Act 369's amendment to 16508, full and final power over how the law may be executed through resolutions in these categories. The Department of Justice must submit every proposed resolution to the legislature's Joint Committee on Finance for its affirmative approval. And if JCF does not take action or refuses or declines the proposed resolution, 165.081 leaves the executive branch with no ability to override that decision to execute the law. Now, tellingly, the legislature has never disputed throughout this litigation that resolving these categories constitutes law execution. How could it? Every decision as to whether to resolve a particular action, when that makes sense in the context of the case against a particular defendant, business or individual, and how to craft that resolution is executing the law, applying generally applicable law to particular factual circumstances. Instead, the legislature has tried three strategies to excuse its unprecedented and unparalleled intrusion into execution of the law in these categories. It's done three things. One, it's tried to hide behind case law that doesn't actually support its position while ignoring case law that directly rejects its arguments. Two, it invents shared legislative roles nowhere to be found in the Constitution that would allow the legislature to consume both branches of co-equal branches of government. And now, before this court, it tries to manufacture a historical tradition based on isolated, lonely instances that don't actually even fall in these categories. So today—
I'm anticipating a question, counsel, so I'll give you one.
Great.
When we're looking at institutional interests that the legislature might have, one that they have asserted is found in Article 8, Section 5. The legislature shall provide for an annual tax sufficient to defray the estimated expenses of the state each year, and whenever the expenses of any year shall exceed the income, the legislature shall provide for levying a tax for the ensuing year sufficient with other sources of income. So the revenue that is generated from these sorts of actions are other sources of income. Why is that not an institutional interest of the legislature that suffices for it to have a seat at the table here?
Because what that constitutional provision imposes is a duty and responsibility on the legislature to impose tax through law. And so all that other sources of income language is talking about is that the legislature is to be aware of what other sources of income may be coming into the state and factor that in when it's accounting for how much it can tax, the tax having to be uniform, that having to go through law moving forward. Nothing in that provision gives the legislature power to then control the co-equal branch activities that could bring money in. And when we look at the state XRL Owen v. Donald case that the legislature cites, what this court said in 1915 is that the legislature's taxing power, like its power to appropriate money out of the treasury, is intended to tie the hands of the legislature, which phrased as a grant of power is really a limitation. And so what that is providing is that the legislature cannot impose a tax higher than what is necessary to accomplish those purposes. And what the legislature can do constitutionally to understand sources of income coming into the state, also provided in the Constitution. The legislature can audit the Department of Justice if it has any questions as to how much money is coming in through plaintiff side settlements. The legislature can also, and indeed have, impose laws that direct how money received from these settlements are to be credited once they enter the state treasury. And so nothing in that provision in Article 8, Section 5, would give the legislature an ability to control the co-equal branches simply because it has that responsibility to impose a uniform tax. And so
Attorney Jurist, I want to ask you a question about your friend's argument on the other side. And over in their brief, they say that the state has been unable to identify even one example where the Joint Committee has impeded the state's interests. They cite to, I think it was a declaration by Assistant Attorney General Corey Finkelmeyer and others. And I'm interested in what your response is.
Sure. So a few pieces in response. First and foremost, that discussion is irrelevant because any intrusion into core executive branch power by the legislature is unconstitutional. And so if the court agrees with us that this is a core, resolving these categories constitutes core executive power, then any discussion of that has no relevance. And that's similarly true under a shared powers analysis because the executive branch is left as a matter of law without any ability to override the legislature to perform its own constitutional role. But let's assume we are getting to the facts. Then first, as to that particular deposition that Your Honor is referencing and the legislature's reliance on that, that is a December 2021 deposition. The legislature tries to use that to say that Mr. Finkelmeyer could not identify any multi-state action at that point where 165.081's veto power in these categories had affected the department. The legislature knows full well why that's the case. And that's because until March of 2022, so after that deposition, after the legislature sued us in a separate case challenging the department's statutory interpretation of 165.081, the Department of Justice did not understand 165.081 to apply to the types of resolutions that we enter in multi-state matters. And so in multi-state matters, these are large civil actions that really most of the work, almost everything is happening before anything is ever filed in court. These are against large corporations. And so based on the language of 165.081, which addresses actions prosecuted by the department, we didn't understand that to be, understand 165.081 to apply. So I think that example, and they're having to rely on the fact, that fact just further shows that they're trying to sort of distort facts to support their case. But let's talk about the facts that we do have in the record that are uncontroverted that show exactly what you expect to see from a co-equal branch having veto power over another. We've explained that this veto power, this is at 97 pages 12 to 13 in the record, infects having this sword, the legislative committee sword hanging over our head, infects our decision-making at every stage and every action in these categories, whether to prosecute, how to prosecute, how to talk with our clients, when to pursue negotiation, and the terms. We've presented 13 cases that JCF as a body never even convened to consider. That's at 97.15 to 16. We've presented, and I think this is a particularly poignant example, letters submitted by the co-chairs from JCF where they refused to have the committee even consider proposed resolutions until the department agreed to forfeit. In each case, it was a total of $5,000 of attorney's fees, contrary to the department's position in another lawsuit. We've presented the example of a Category 2 executive agency action involving millions of dollars that has been on hold for years because both sides want to enter settlement, but it appears that the defendant is uncomfortable presenting and putting all of its cards on the table to a legislative committee. And I could keep going, but those their assertion that we haven't presented anything is just based on the fact that we will not identify case names due to confidentiality concerns.
Thank you.
But ultimately, as I noted, that's all irrelevant because what we're talking about is core executive power. And of course, any intrusion by a co-equal branch into the core power of another constitutes a separation of powers violation.
Do you think, counsel, I wonder if you had any more response to that 1909 law that was cited there? And I'm curious if this court agrees its core power, would that implicate that law as well? Particularly the provision of that, I think, required approval by the legislature, I think, for it. Curious as your response on that.
So absolutely. So what Your Honor is referring to is a one-off 1909 law creating a committee to address both plaintiff side and defense side actions involving major railroad corporations concerning what was a license fee effective tax system that apparently itself was also highly controversial and subject to a number of challenges. And so that absolutely is not a Category 1 civil enforcement action. It's also not a Category 2 action. And the primary reason it's not is because it involved both plaintiff side actions, so actions brought by the state, and actions brought by the railroads themselves. That's confirmed. You can see that in the 1911 provision where it's discussing the resolutions. It talks about claims and counterclaims. And so that's not at issue in Category 2. We have expressly excluded from Category 2 any instance where a counterclaim would require us to pay money out. That is not present here. But more importantly, even if the court were to accept that that one example did fall within our second category, then we would say that's unconstitutional. And even if the court were to disagree with us that that one example would be unconstitutional, one instance in 170 years of Wisconsin history is not anywhere close to the sort of historical tradition that this court will look to confirm whether something is a core power of a particular branch or not. And that makes sense because, as the New Hampshire Supreme Court has recognized in the case that we cite, not every isolated instance is going to be the subject of constitutional challenge. So instead, if you look at cases like this court's decision in Friedrich, where the court addressed a law imposing rates on the compensation of guardian ad litems and special prosecutors, this court noted a history from the beginning of the state of Wisconsin on through of a legislative role in setting those compensation rates. That is nothing close to what we have here. And of course, the three other isolated examples that the legislature tries to rely on aren't even close to the categories. There is an 1849 law that doesn't fit within these categories because it both concerned a criminal prosecution against a particular person for embezzlement, and second, because it was an action brought at the request of the legislature, and in no action within these categories is the legislature the authorizing entity or the client to the prosecuted action. They point to an 1856 law that is just a precursor to what today is 165-25-1M, which authorizes the Department of Justice to prosecute actions at the request of the legislature or governor. Again, in no action within these categories is the legislature the client or the authorizing entity. And then they point to a 1915 law creating an executive branch committee to resolve matters against the United States government related to swamps. No separation of powers problem there. That's an executive branch committee. And I think this distinction, the fact that in no action within these categories is the legislature the authorizing entity or client, is why, as we have been saying for years, this court did not decide these categories in SEIU. Look at paragraph 67 of SEIU. It recognizes-
Before we get to paragraph 67, can we look at paragraph 63?
Sure.
Is your core powers argument in conflict with that portion of the opinion, which says, while representing the state in litigation is predominantly an executive function, it is within those borderlands of shared powers, most notably in cases that implicate an institutional interest of the legislature. It seems to me the argument on both sides is that we have to find an institutional interest, but this provision, this paragraph of the opinion says it is within the borderlands of shared powers. Could you address that, please?
Absolutely. So our argument is not in any way consistent with that, because we have to consider what the court was doing in SEIU, which the court went to painstaking lengths, I think, to really make clear what it was doing. And that was, it had before it facial challenges to multiple Act 369 statutes. And so it considered three different Act 369 litigation control provisions in full. And so in the context of SEIU, this court was looking at, though, a broader category, or a broader set than what we're talking about here. And this court stressed that because of the facial challenges to those statutes, it had to, it essentially was working backwards from constitutional to find any one instance where the particular law, where the legislative intrusion would be constitutional, and that it went no further. It told us twice, paragraph 73 and paragraphs 86, that it was not deciding any categories of application. So I think that paragraph 63 that Your Honor is referencing, if we are talking about the much broader category of all state litigation, that's what that's referring to. That's not what is at issue here. And I would put to the court that this court very recently, in what I'll call Evers 1, made clear what should be the unremarkable proposition that the executive branch has the power to execute the law, that the legislature's constitutional power is to write the law, and that when the legislature is done writing the law, its role generally ends. And so I think that makes clear where the starting point is, and that's not, shouldn't be anything controversial, that's the Constitution.
Huh. So, but going... Can I just follow up, please? Going back to the principle that is espoused in this paragraph, mm-hmm. It seems crystal clear to me, because it is so broadly worded, that it's talking about all litigation involving the state. So does it not defeat your argument that this is a core power of the executive when the court was so explicit in saying that when it comes to state litigation, it's a shared power, even though it may be predominantly executive?
No, I don't think that's at all correct. And the reason why that's not correct is because time and again, what this court has told us in separation of powers cases is that you are looking at the particular activity, right? The analysis is the particular activity that is at issue in the challenge. And so there in SEIU, the particular activity was all state litigation under these challenge that was implicated by these the three different litigation control provisions.
Are you asking us to overturn that paragraph? Do you think it got it wrong?
I don't think, under our understanding, I don't think the court needs to do any overturning of SEIU, but if we're wrong, and that through that paragraph alone, this court meant to say that it was actually deciding that state litigation is always going to be a shared power, contradicting, then I think you have a paragraph 73 and 86 problem that you'd have to take action on. But I think that just shows that that reading of paragraph 63 isn't correct. And when you look at SEIU, the three legislative interests that could at least exist in at least some cases that the court recognized, none of those are ever present in these categories. And no action in these categories is the legislature ever, as I have said, the client or the authorizing entity, and no action in these categories is the legislature required to appropriate money out of the treasury by law. And while this court addressed it in the context of the intervention provision and not the plaintiff and defense side litigation control provisions, in no action in these categories would the resolution involve conceding invalidity of state law. We've expressly excluded that.
Counsel? Are you satisfied?
Thank you.
Yes. I just want to nail this, mm-hmm. and that is with regard to SEIU, of course, there were multiple opinions in that case.
Yes.
But as to the precedential value of SEIU, is there anything that you would change in that opinion?
So we haven't asked for SEIU to be disrupted in any way. What I would say is I think the legislature has now for years taken certain words and descriptions used in SEIU to argue something that this court didn't actually intend to say in SEIU. And so I think one example of that and where that has been misinterpreted is this idea of interest. We understand SEIU to say that where the legislature's constitutional powers and duties could be implicated by a particular resolution, that means, working again back from the facial challenge where it just required one instance, that was enough to defeat the facial challenge. The legislature has taken the use of the word interest and said, well, we have an interest in any money going in or out of the state of Wisconsin. We have an interest in anything related to policy, whether it relates to lawmaking. And they've taken that to say that that means that somehow they would be able to have a shared role here. And so I think the court should clarify that by interest, all we're talking about are the powers and roles vested in the Constitution. And that's entirely consistent with what this court has said in Evers 1 as well. I think we've already had the discussion about what paragraph 63 did and did not mean. We think that the court can explain, and frankly, that the court went out of its way in SEIU to tell us the nature of the challenge that it was doing. But I think that is another place that has perhaps resulted in some confusion.
Are you done?
Oh, and the last thing I would just say is that I think working with Evers 1 as the starting point, that is, we start from the place that the executive branch executes the law, the legislature writes the law, that SEIU did just what it told us it was doing. And that was working backwards from constitutional to find just any rare instance where the legislature may have a shared role, that it wasn't making any sort of affirmative holdings beyond that.
I just wanted to ask you about your footnote 2 mm-hmm. in your brief and just the way we would view this. I understand you to say it doesn't matter if we view it from the lens of beyond a reasonable doubt or if we choose not to apply that lens in the separation of powers context, because either way you need beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
But do you have a preference in how we view this in this? I mean, if you had your preference, how would you have us?
So I think, and you can see the fact that the court really hasn't discussed that standard in a lot of its recent decisions, and we absolutely agree that that standard should not apply in the context of a separation of powers challenge because it puts a thumb on the scale in favor of the legislature. We just haven't taken that up because we don't need to, where this is quintessential core power.
Mr. Can I ask you to go back to the discussion we're having just a minute ago about the institutional interests. And as I understand the argument on their side, there are a couple that they have identified. One is power of the purse in this case, and the second one is policymaking. They then went through and had, it was at least three or four, I think it was three hypotheticals and then a couple of real world.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if you can speak to those. I don't know that you need to speak to all of them. Perhaps you could answer it in a way that covers all of them. But the first one, for instance, is a settlement with a landlord with a monetary condition requiring the landlord to pay $10 million into the AG's preferred housing nonprofit.
Yep.
Can you respond in general to?
Sure, absolutely. So to refer to that in particular, what the legislature can do, and this is reflected in Evers 1, is it can set the rules of the road in terms of how the executive branch can resolve these categories of actions in a generally applicable way. What it cannot do is give itself the power to try to control the play mid game. So to use that hypothetical in particular, the legislature indeed has enacted a law that prohibits the Department of Justice, this is 778.027, from negotiating away a prosecution in exchange for giving money to a particular nonprofit. use the tobacco resolution from the 1990s. I think that's a great example. It's not entirely a category one action because there were also some tort claims involved, but setting that aside for the moment. What the legislature could do is exactly what it did. Once the settlement was entered, the legislature passed laws directing how money was to be credited and expended once the settlement had already been entered. That comports with separation of powers. But if 165.081 existed at the time, and then instead what that would have meant is, hey, 44 other states, we're entering this gigantic resolution with the major tobacco companies. You know, we know that everybody else has come to this agreement. It has to be really confidential, but excuse us, we're going to have to hold everything, and we have to take this to the legislature, a committee of our legislature, so that they can decide whether they want to rewrite this agreement or allow us to enter it or not. That's what they cannot do.
And my understanding is they would not necessarily have had to meet, right? When you're saying we're going to take it to a committee of the legislature.
Oh, right. Well, once we submit it to the legislature, the statute imposes no requirement on JCF to act. It imposes no requirement on when JCF has to act. The executive branch is left with zero ability to override JCF to execute the law. And the last piece I would say to the sort of scope and policy argument that the legislature is raising, the way that the Wisconsin Constitution accounts for that is that the executive branch is politically accountable to the people. So if the attorney general enters a settlement, let's say in the tobacco settlement, the attorney general had said, we just want $10, and I see my, thank you. We just want $10, we don't really care. Well, the way our constitution provides for accountability on that is by the election of the attorney general. The people get to make that decision. The legislature does not get to control our execution of the law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Misha Zaitlin for the legislature. In SEIU, this court rejected facial challenges to the Joint Finance Committee settlement approval provisions in Act 369, including Section 26. In the Attorney General's brief and now at oral argument, the Attorney General disclaims any challenge to SEIU itself. That means that the structure, the JCF approval structure that SEIU blessed as a facial matter, is not before this court. Which means that a lot of the criticisms that you heard of the structure thereafter in today's argument in the brief are completely irrelevant. The only question I would respectfully submit that's before this court is the one that SEIU puts, which is, this, there even one example of a potential settlement within their two very broad categories that triggers the institutional interest of the legislature? Of course there is, especially in cases impacting the public fisc under Article 8, Section 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution. Now, when we're talking about settlements, it's important to remember, we're talking about not the Department of Justice's money, not the agency's money, but the people's money. So I think the clearest current modern example is the opioid settlement. That was $420 million of the people's money. The legislation requiring joint finance approval followed the exact same procedures as Section 26. The settlement was submitted to the Joint Finance Committee, and it was approved by the Joint Finance Committee. Of course, the legislature, in carrying out its constitutional duty to balance the budget of the state, had to take into account all sources of income, including that $420 million that the opioid companies harmed the people of Wisconsin, that then led to that lawsuit. Now,
Attorney Zaitlin, taking your argument to its logical conclusion, you just said that it, of course, they have to take into account all sources of income. So any source of income that comes into the legislature, they've got control over. So could the legislature appoint a committee to review tax returns to make sure that they're getting the money they're supposed to?
Certainly a committee could study those kind of things. And what I'm saying,
I'm not talking about studying. I'm talking about a structure the way you're saying. You're saying any money coming in. I guess my point in asking the question, whether or not you'll say whether that does, where does this end? Every single dollar that comes in means the legislature has total control, and there's no, there, the exceptions in SEIU are moot, and there's no role for executive power here.
Well, look, Your Honor, what we took from SEIU was that the court, for these kind of provisions, put a test saying that when the legislature's institutional interest is at stake, it can have a seat at the table. It didn't say that this was for all kinds of laws in other areas. It said,
where the stopping point is. That's what I don't get. If you're saying it's the public fisc and it's any money coming in, then they could do anything. They're always getting money coming in. So tell me where the stopping point is.
I just to clarify your question, Your Honor, do you mean in other kinds of laws or with regard to Section 26 and Section 30?
I'm going beyond Section 26 because to me, your argument, public fisc, we control the money. We have to figure out how much to pay out next year. We have to figure how much to tax people uniformly. Therefore, we can control any single piece of money coming in, which includes tax returns for the average citizen. So I'm trying to understand where your guardrails are. Tell me where your argument ends.
Right. So paragraph 63 of SIU, which Justice Bradley quoted, says that litigation on behalf of the state is predominantly an executive power, but not a core executive power. When you have a situation where it's not a core power, then you have a balance, right? And so what this court set out in SEIU was a test, an institutional interest test, that isn't the test for other kinds of laws. And if you all remember back when I was arguing SEIU, that was not our primary argument. Our primary argument was the Attorney General has no power at all. This doesn't have any constitutional implications. This court rejected that argument and adopted a middle ground position, which is an institutional interest test, not a constitutional power test. And so we have.
You think the institutional interests don't have to be rooted in the Constitution?
Sorry, Your Honor?
The institutional interests don't have to be rooted in the Constitution?
No, they do have to be rooted in the Constitution, but they don't have to then give the legislature plenary authority to act in every way in relation to that. What the court was saying in SEIU, and I think it's pretty clear, is that this structure is okay for certain kinds of examples, certain kinds of cases. Not that it was saying that anytime the institutional interest is at stake, legislature could enact any type of law with any kind of structure that would then be constitutional. Now, just to turn to the factual issues that Justice Carossi asked about, and this goes to also your partial dissent in SAU, Justice Dallet. So what the facts that Your Honor wanted to have developed in on remand in SAU, how does this function as a practical matter? So the Attorney General, who has the obligation, you know, as the party bringing the lawsuit, even if, you know, Your Honor doesn't want to have a beyond reasonable doubt standard, they put out an affidavit from then Assistant Administrator Finkelmeyer that said, well, this is causing us all kinds of practical problems. We're missing multi-state settlements. It's delaying important time-sensitive things. And as happens in litigation, we said, okay, that's your affiant. Let's have a deposition. Let's ask you about all of the vague claims that you make in your affidavit. We asked him, do you have any example of the legislature not timely approving a settlement that caused any problems for DOJ? Refused to provide an answer. Do you have any example of legislature disclosing any confidential information as part of the settlement? Refused to provide an example. Do you have any example of the state missing out on a multi-state case because refused to provide an answer?
But there, excuse me, I think their response to that is that there is this overlooming that JCF is they cast a shadow over the Attorney General's ability to do anything in these cases, and that the fact that they, I mean, you know what it's like to try to settle a case, right? I mean, you're talking to the lawyers and you all know what the facts are and you know what the law is and you're trying to negotiate something. And especially in the situation where Attorney Jurist was given about the, you know, the example of maybe there's 44 other states. So they're saying that despite that deposition, that there is still this umbrella or this shadow that JCF is casting over the Attorney General. And that is what the issue is.
I mean, that's an empirical, I mean, at bottom, that's an empirical claim. This is the kind of, you know, evidence that Justice Dowlett was talking about that would be before the circuit court if the remand had happened in SEIU. And what happened is we tested that. Mr. Finkelmeyer said these kind of things, and we said, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Give us specific examples. And with regard to the confidentiality,
you're asking them to prove a negative. It's the problem is that it is the fact that the Joint Finance Committee won't act in time. That is something that won't. How are they supposed to prove that they wanted something settled in a certain amount of time? And they're just like, you're having them prove inaction, which is impossible.
Well, let me give a very specific example of that. And this relates to what my friend on the other side was saying with the multi-state settlement. The opioid settlement. They came to us in the middle of the settlement and said, we have a potentially urgent settlement. We got to meet on 2 business days notice. GFC convened on 2 business days notice. Then the Attorney General called, didn't present the settlement there. A couple more months went by. They negotiated the final settlement on the OPO settlement. Met on 4 business days notice around Thanksgiving. So what we asked Mr. Finkelmeyer is, that's in the record. Do you dispute that we met on 2 business days notice when you told us it was urgent? Then we asked him, has there ever been an example ever when you told us a settlement was urgent and we didn't meet? Couldn't provide an example. Has there ever been an example where we caused you guys any problems with multi-state settlements, which was mentioned by a treasurer? He said, not sitting here right now, but I will get back to you on that.
Attorney Seidlin,
did not get it back to us with any information.
If we decide this is a core power, that argument goes away, right? We don't have to have a whole discussion about how much someone was burdened. If this is core executive power, the legislature doesn't get to infringe, right?
Think of it, if it's core executive power, you lose, don't you?
No, of course, if your honors overturn paragraph 63
don't you?
Of yes, of course, if your honors overturn paragraph 63 of SEIU.
But wait a second, you've now taken another leap about overturning paragraph 63. SEIU has been discussed by your friend on the other side, involved facial challenges. I don't see paragraph 63 as saying what you're arguing to say. SEIU left open situations, particular situations where there may be executive power.
Obviously, this court is gonna tell us all what paragraph 63 means going forward. But as I read paragraph 63, it is very clear, in my opinion, that it says that it's a predominantly executive power, but it's in the borderlands. And what I think the rest of it is saying is, even though it's not a core power, it could still be unconstitutional.
At least
if circumstances
in all at least in all circumstances. That's what it says. With it is they argue that the Attorney General's power to litigate on behalf of the state is not, at least in all circumstances, within the exclusive zone. That doesn't say it's not in other circumstances. I mean, that's quite a read you have of that.
Well, paragraph 63 specifically describes it as predominantly an executive power, and then immediately thereafter, it says it's in the borderlands. Now, I'm not saying that everything in settlement that SEIU held that every single potential settlement example as an as-applied challenge would be constitutional, but unconstitutional. But I don't think that's because you would be concluding that it's a core executive power. I think you would be applying the SEIU test, and the SEIU test is it's predominantly executive power, so the legislature can only have a seat at the table when there's an institutional interest of the legislature at stake.
So let me clarify, because I guess maybe I don't understand. You are saying it's shared power, period, and the SEIU does not stand for the proposition that there are areas that are core executive. You're saying there is no area of core executive power when it comes to litigation representing the state. Is that what I hear you saying?
That's what paragraph 63 says.
Okay, so
that has to be your argument. Because if that's not your argument, if your argument is that it is a core power, I don't see how you.
Oh, his argument wasn't. But I see what you're saying.
Your Honor, we certainly didn't argue. Now, look, if your honors believe that there are some examples of core powers within their broad categories, the lawsuit would still fail. It's only if your honors believes that every single example of settlements within their 2 categories as core powers, do they succeed? And that would mean that the 1909 law would be unconstitutional. And I want to make the case that it would mean that the specific law that dealt with Mr. Merrill, enacted by the very first legislature, would clearly be unconstitutional. What the legislature required there is it said, oh, Mr. Merrill, you know, embezzled some money from selling some canal lands and whatnot. So, you know, the prescription there was much more prescriptive. It said, you got to bring a mandamus petition in this court. You got to prosecute him to final judgment. You got to get the money back. That is way more prescriptive and way more stepping on whatever one wants to describe the attorney general's leeway as than the settlement approval provisions here. The other odd feature of my friend's argument, I think, is also highlighted by that legislation, which was enacted by our very first legislature. So what their position, I take it, is that if the legislature go the attorney general suing David Merrill to get those monies, the legislature has no interest in that, even though that's the state money. But if you had the same exact money, but it happened to have been in the legislature's hands, and David Merrill was suing to get that same exact pot of money, because he said, I actually did this stuff with the canals, then it would be constitutional for the legislature to have a seat at the table. Not only is that historically inept, but that also just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Counsel, Justice Stallett asked your opposing counsel about retaining the beyond a reasonable doubt standard in the context of separation of power cases. Your opposing counsel brought a smile to my face when she endorsed a separate writing of mine in the past, indicating that no, it shouldn't be retained. What's your best argument for retaining the beyond a reasonable doubt standard in the context of separation of powers?
Well, my first argument would, of course, be stare decisis. This argument was put to this court, at least in Martinez and SEIU, and I think probably in Markline, if I recall, and this court did not adopt it. You know, further, they did not attempt, at least in this case, to make a showing under the Johnson control factors to overturn that. But if this court was considering the issue anew, I would say that if a law is enacted, it has to be passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't be subject to constitutional challenge, mm-hmm. but there is an important solemnity to a piece of legislation that gets through the strictures of bicameralism and presentment.
Yes.
So that's what... that's what gives it that weight. And that doesn't mean that every law would win. I mean, in SEIU, I won some, I lost some. I mean, we lost the provisions related to guidance documents. We won the ones related to Section 26 and, you know, using that standard.
What do you think of opposing counsel's argument that there's accountability via elections?
Certainly, that is true. But the legislature, by the Constitution, is held responsible for making sure that there is a balanced budget and accounting for all of the sources of income. And certainly the legislature, and they concede in their reply brief, could pass legislation saying this particular opioid settlement has to have X, Y, and Z. And which is, by the way, in that same piece of legislation. But if the legislature can do that, and if the superstructure of GFC is permissible, which SAU says it is, I do not see a principal reason why the legislature can't also use the GFC process to make sure that it's carrying out that responsibility. If the legislature has a sufficient constitutional interest in saying the opioid money's got to go here and that, and not, as my friend said here at oral argument, with only prospective generally applicable legislation, but as they conceded in their reply brief, with a piece of legislation that governed specifically MDL 284-2804, said some amount of money of the opioids need to go to localities and some needs to go to the state. That shows that the legislature has legitimate interest in ensuring that the state's finances are balanced. And so I think that this then passes the SEIU test.
Mr. Counsel, are you,
go ahead.
Counsel, are you making any argument under Article 6, which says the powers and duties of the Attorney General shall be prescribed by law? That seems to suggest that the provisions that are under attack by DOJ, by the Attorney General here, could be defeated by that article.
Yeah, I mean, as I was mentioning, that was our lead argument in SEIU, that under Oak Creek and that provision, the Attorney General had no constitutional power whatsoever. I lost on that argument. We didn't get any votes on that argument, so I'm not bringing it back here. So as I'm saying that you got to keep SEIU in place for the parts that we prevailed, I'm not standing before the court saying overturn SEIU for the parts. Look, I re-listened to my argument in SEIU today, and I still thought I was right, and I remember no one agreed with me, and obviously in the writings I didn't get any traction.
I guess
traction.
I'm asking you what is left of that provision if, in fact, this court, perhaps in SEIU, wrongfully accorded the Attorney General powers that people never gave him.
Yeah, no, I do think it is a troubling result of that holding that essentially the Attorney General seems to now have some amount of common law constitutionalized powers. But again, we are fine with where SEIU left us. Obviously, arguments were made and lost, but which is that we got to point to an institutional interest to be able to have a co-equal seat at the table in settlements like this.
The Attorney General does seem to concede, though, that the legislature could pass laws that would circumscribe the Attorney General's powers, just not this law. So what does the legislature say to that argument, that it can simply make the laws that would circumscribe the Attorney General's powers when it comes to settlements?
Well, the legislature can't do that, but since the very first legislature, we've been doing more than that. We've been, when the public fisc is at issue, including when Mr. Merrill stole a bunch of money from the state, we've been taking a more close hand. And then the railroad cases are a great example. The opioid case that just happened is another great example. Sometimes the public fisc is so at issue that the legislature has taken a hand, and sometimes has done it through different kinds of structures.
How many members of JFC would it take to actually halt the settlement?
Sorry.
How many members of the Joint Finance Committee would it take to halt the settlement? What's the fewest number of people that could stop a settlement?
I apologize. I don't remember that sitting here. I remembered that when we were doing the prior argument.
It's like three or four.
I apologize and get back to the court afterwards, but I will also say that to the extent that we're doing the kind of analysis that Justice Dowell talked about in the SEIU dissent, there's no example of that in the operations of in the entire operation of this provision. In terms of the public record, there's been over 90 settlements, not a single dissenting vote on JFC. This process has functioned well, and if it broke down and three recalcitrant members were blocking important multi-state settlements of that sort, then perhaps an as-applied challenge could be brought. But the test was put to us by my friends. They said, we can prove up that this process is not working. They submitted an affidavit, sworn affidavit, to the court. Then we deposed their affiant, and he couldn't give us any examples. And this claim of confidentiality does not hold water when they are the ones bringing the lawsuit, and everybody knows that even if you have confidential information that you need to win your lawsuit, you can file it under seal, court eyes only, attorney's eyes only, to prove up your theory.
Mr. Chen, I want to move on and ask some questions about Evers 1 or Markland 1, because I feel like when I read your brief, I felt like you just kind of wanted perhaps to pretend that that case didn't exist, and you... At one point, you have on page 40 of your brief, you write that the Constitution expressly affords the legislature an oversight role for the state's finances. And I'm just not sure how you reconcile that with language. And some people are calling it Markland 1, Evers 1. You know what I'm talking about, I think. So in paragraph 20, that decision said, while the legislature's motivation for overseeing the public fisc may be well-intentioned, fundamentally, the legislature may not execute the law. It then goes on to say, this is in paragraph 23, the legislature may not insert its own committee into the machinery of the executive branch in an attempt to control the executive law. And I just am having a very hard time understanding how your argument fits with the Markline decision.
So Markline held that spending appropriated funds was core executive. Paragraph 63 of SEIU says that litigation on behalf of the state is predominantly executive, but it's in the borderlands. So just like I answered Justice Dallet, if the court holds that litigation on behalf of the state is core executive, which, by the way, means that, you know, those historical examples would have all have been unconstitutional, including from the very first legislature, then yeah, then I lose. And then it becomes like Evers won. But it seems odd to me to talk about what Evers won ruled with regard to a different kind of power when you have a directly on point precedent from this court, SEIU, not only dealing with just this general kind of power, but dealing with this very specific provision. So we, you know, Markline 1 has principles, it cites SEIU multiple times with approval, but where I have a case directly on this very provision, I'm gonna take the position, I think sensibly, that we gotta look at that case. It's a modern case, you know, they're not asking to have it overturned.
And you don't see distinctions between these laws that you cited, like the fact that the legislature was asking to recover the money for them, that the railroad case, the railroad law involved counterclaims also against the state, and that the other example you cited was involving an executive committee. You don't see any distinction between those cases and what we have here?
Well, let me talk about the railroad case. That would just say that I also asked about that one. Mm-hmm. In that circumstance, it was all of the lawsuits against the railroads for these unpaid fees were being first negotiated by a committee that had 5 out of the 6 members were legislators. And then after that, also had to be approved by the legislature. Yes, some of them might have had counterclaims, but they would have fought. So can I just...
Yeah, but you said some of them might have had counterclaims, so it might have involved different money issues than here, which is only plaintiff's side with no other claims, no other counterclaims.
That's the next thing I was saying. That's absolutely not true. Their case involves examples with counterclaims. The only counterclaims that are carved out of their amended complaint are those where the counterclaim is more than the claim brought to the state. And, you know, I don't think that that my friend on the other side is going to say anything different in rebuttal. The only one that they carved out was when, because they were concerned about a certain situation where the state's seeking $5, but then the counterclaim is $1 million. And the end result is that almost $1 million has to be paid out of the treasury. Then under their theory of SEIU, that would involve an appropriation from the legislature, and so there would be a constitutional. They did not carve out the example of counterclaims like the examples that we have pointed out in our brief, where the legislature was approving the settlements with the railroad entities, where all of those, I believe, had more money coming from the railroad entities than was being forgiven by the state as part of the settlement.
Counsel, I wanted to go back to a question that Justice Dallet asked earlier, and that's the limiting principle to your public fisc argument. Is your argument that anytime anything impacting anything on either side of the ledger, that is something that the legislature can appropriately step in and sort of act in some executive capacity?
No, that is not at all my position. I am saying that for Section 26 or Section 30's settlement structure, a public fisc interest is sufficient under the SEIU test to make that settlement fall within a constitutional zone.
So, I'll limit it then to the Attorney General, though maybe it has broader application. I mean, that principle would potentially have much broader applications to other separation of powers questions, but I'll take your point and keep it to this one here. So your argument is, though, anytime anything deals with revenue that could come into the treasury, that is sufficient to put this in a sort of shared powers where the legislature can have some kind of veto power over settlements.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the plaintiff side and defense side are mirror images of each other, really. So this court held in SEIU that, you know, the power of the purse was a sufficient institutional interest. And I think that it would make no sense to have a constitutional rule that says the legislature can have a constitutional seat at the table when there's a lawsuit to the state for $1 million, but when this, but not have a constitutional interest whether the state is bringing a lawsuit for $1 million. And you know, the way I talked about the Mr. Mail example, I think shows that, because a lot of times the fight is over a corpus, like a particular million. If the it does not change the constitutional analysis whether that million and the moment of the lawsuit is currently being held by Mr. Merrill or currently being held by the straight treasury. If the legislature has an interest in that $1 million, it has it regardless of how it happens to be that the lawsuit comes about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think SAU pointed to the power to appropriate money as at least you know, relying on that power, but I take your argument to be just that there isn't necessarily a limiting principle, that to the extent litigation affects the treasury, that that is something the legislature will always have an interest in, sufficient to do what it asserts to do in these cases.
Yeah, what I when I talked about this in SEIU, what I said is, you know, there could be a de minimis examples, you know, there's not much money at stake, whatnot. But when you have, they have to win the hardest case, not the easiest case. And the hardest case for them is $420 million. That's not hypothetical.
Well, I agree, but I guess I'm not sure what the constitutional difference would be between $400 million or $400. If the argument is it affects the public fisc, that doesn't seem like it should matter. So I'm just trying to figure out what the logical sort of, and if your argument is anytime it affects the treasury, you know, the treasury, you know, inputs, that's fine. I'm trying to make sure I understand sort of the principle that you're putting forward, because it you know, might have broad implications.
I mean, I don't think it's broader implications than the courts holding a power of the purse. I mean, you know, one could make the same point, you know, that the appropriation could be for, you know, $400. You know, you could make the same point. I think the same rule would generally apply, but this court and SEIU didn't feel necessary to go that far. I don't read SEIU to be saying that even if a $1 appropriation, that would be sufficient for the settlement. But it said there's at least some examples that would involve a large amount of, that would involve money that would be constitutional. And that's what I would urge this court to hold here. You know, it seems to me a very bizarre rule where you have the legislature in from the very first legislature of the state's history acting with regard to, you know, a couple $1,000s and obviously inflation with regard to an individual having a very prescriptive role with the attorney general's role, that was fine. But for some reason, but when you have $420 million, the legislature can't have a seat at the table at that. It just seems like that gets the separation of analysis kind of backwards.
All right, thank you. Counsel, what do you say to this apparent lack of any limiting principle, any place, any time, that causes me to pause?
I agree, and I would go
or choke, whichever you
want. I would agree. I would say that it's terrifying because that would eviscerate the separation of powers by allowing the legislature to control both co-equal branches, not just the executive branch. So let's replace control of these plaintiff-side civil actions with Wisconsin Circuit Court and appellate decisions. Judges all the time across the state issue decisions or make other rulings that could affect in cases against the government or brought by the government, how much money is coming into the state treasury. This court and the Court of Appeals issue published decisions that could affect policy outside of lawmaking that, unlike plaintiff side civil actions, do, which only bind the parties to the litigation, do bind the entire state. And so what you heard from the legislature today was exactly what we've said, which is that they take interest in everything.
I think that's overstating it, because there isn't comparable constitutional provisions that would give the legislature an interest in the decision-making of this court, and we'd have a constitutional crisis. What we do have, though, is Article 6, Section 3, saying the powers and duties of the Attorney General shall be as prescribed by law. And as I go over SEIU, traced back the history mm-hmm. of when, and it was, as we said in that case, that it was contemporaneous almost with the adoption of the Constitution. The legislature did prescribe and enacted a law requiring the Attorney General to appear for the state in any court or tribunal and in any other causes, criminal or civil, in which the state may be a party or be interested. And we went on to say these early prescriptions adopted nearly contemporaneously with the adoption of our state constitution reflect an understanding that the Attorney General's role is not, at least in all cases, core executive function. What are we to make, has this court and SEIU under your argument sort of written out section 3 of articles?
No, not at all. Because with
what's left then for the legislature to do, because the legislature in the provision that you're attacking has prescribed the powers and duties of the Attorney General, which is to basically give a check or balance. The legislature has a check or balance on what the Attorney General is doing. And what I find frightening is that one person gets to make all of the policy decisions under your argument about what is going to be done with what is the taxpayers' money. It's not the Attorney General's money, but he could allocate that money to private interests with which he might be aligned. That can't be, can it, counsel? A lot of questions in there for you.
Sure, and I'm happy to take them in pieces. So let's use the opioid settlement as an example. I think my friend on the other side tried to say we conceded something in reply brief. No, the opioid settlement statute, 165.12, is a great example of what the legislature can do, what it can't do. What it can do is 165.12 sub 3, which directs how that money is to be allocated and spent once the settlement is entered. What it cannot do is 165.12 sub 2, which is the legislature taking for itself control of how the law is executed in real time, right? Controlling the play mid-game. And the reason that it cannot do this, and I know Your Honor knows this well, is that the separation of powers rests upon the fundamental principle that the same hands, the power should not be in the same hands to both write the law and execute it. Because what that then allows is the legislative branch to write generally applicable laws that have to apply to everybody, but then control. Actually, you know what? We don't like this particular business, so we want you to obtain more money from that business. Or we do like that particular individual, so maybe ease up on the injunctive relief. And that's the very sort of dangers that separation of powers works to protect against.
But you think the Attorney General has all of that power, but you say the legislature doesn't, but they're the people's representatives, are they not?
Well, Your Honor, I would quote from Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, which is quoted extensively in Federalist 48, recognizing that 173 despots would surely be as oppressive as one. It is not which branch that has assumed the power. It is the concentration of the division, the divided branches and type of power of government into a single hand or single group that is the problem. And that's exactly what has happened here. The state cannot point to any support in the Constitution, in case law, in our history for this intrusion.
Can I ask one quick question? Are you done?
Finish. The red light's on, I'll respect
that. I just had one quick question about the comment that was made about the counterclaims, because I understood your amended complaint to say that these categories do not involve any settlements that would require the payment of money to the defendant via a counterclaim or avenue. So I'm
correct. And thank you for that, Your Honor. So that's absolutely right. So we've excluded category 2, any action that would require the payment of money out of the state via counterclaim or otherwise. And so that's even going further than what the Constitution actually recognizes, because there are many most defense side settlements where no appropriation by law is actually necessary. But so any time that a settlement would result in money going out of the state, that is not within our category.
All right, thank you. Interesting oral argument. We are adjourned. We will reconvene when the courtroom is ready for our second oral argument.